Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on the environment, our connections with and impacts upon that environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the first part of the show is Professor Rose Smith. She's assistant professor in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Utah. And she's here to talk about her involvement in a project, a study of the Jordan River. The University of Utah looked at the river in a couple of different ways, and Professor Smith is here to talk about her efforts. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Professor Smith.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start. I thought we'd start with some background on the Jordan River. It's, as we say in the introduction, it's roughly 50 miles long. It finds its source, I suppose, at the headwaters or the Utah Lake. And then it drains in the Great Salt Lake, and it runs. Actually, it's interesting. It's a river that actually runs south to north, right?
Yeah. So the Jordan River is a really interesting and complicated river. It runs from Utah Lake to the Great Salt Lake, so it has its true headwaters in the mountains, but the local headwaters are this giant basin, Utah Lake, and then it flows into another basin. And then along the way, it flows through this watershed that has over a million people living in it. And so the river is really working hard to both provide water for us, but then also for irrigation, recreation, et cetera. But it's also the location of a lot of waste disposal. So it's a really urbanized river and a really complicated one in terms of the way that the water flows into it and out of it into the Great Salt Lake.
So tell us a little bit about the motivation for the research that you and a couple of your colleagues took on the Jordan River.
Yeah, so the motivation was primarily to understand the biology behind some of the water quality problems that we're seeing in the river. So as I believe you may have mentioned, the river experiences hypoxia, which is basically when the oxygen level in the river gets too low for life to survive. So fishes and benthic organisms, or organisms that live on the bottom of the river, can't survive when the oxygen dips below a certain threshold. So that's kind of one impetus for the study, was to understand how the different pollutants that are entering the river might be contributing to those problems. And as we were sampling and learning more about the river, we realized that toxic algal blooms are also another problem that are facing the river increasingly. So, those two issues are all kind of related to the amount of nutrients that are in the river. So things like nitrogen and phosphorus, which are, they come from fertilizer, but they also come from waste. So the study began kind of trying to understand what are the sources of the waste that get into the river, or the nutrients that get into the river, and then how much can the river, what capacity does the river itself have to regulate those pollutants on its own? Often we think about rivers, especially in urban areas, as kind of pipes or canals that just transport things downstream and get rid of our waste by kind of moving things away from us. Mm-hmm. But they're also very alive and biologically active ecosystems. So that was kind of part of the study. So Dr. Shaw is really interested in the microbial activity in the river. So she was looking at how the microbes can process the nutrients, and then I was looking at kind of the different sources of the nutrients, and then how these how much the river can remove on a mass basis. But as we realized, the further we got into this study, we realized the sources of the water are really complicated. So before we could even get to those questions about the nutrient sources or the amount of biological activity in the river, we had to really understand where the water was coming from.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there. Physical, chemical, biological conditions. I wanted to circle back. You mentioned this term hypoxia. Mm-hmm. That is when a body of water, say, is suffering from low oxygen levels. What creates that low dissolved oxygen condition?
So low dissolved oxygen happens when the biologic activity in the river uses up oxygen naturally, and then it also produces oxygen. So just like we breathe in oxygen and respire carbon dioxide as humans, organisms in the river do the same thing. However, there are also organisms in the river that act like plants, the algae. They take carbon dioxide out of the river or the atmosphere and release oxygen. So there's always this balance of producing and consuming oxygen in a river. That balance can get tipped when too much respiration, so too much consumption of oxygen happens. And that can happen for a few different reasons. Sometimes when the river flow is just too slow, then the biology kind of can take over and basically the river is not being replenished physically with oxygen. But also when there are too many, when there's too much organic matter, which is basically the food that these organisms eat to consume oxygen, when the organic matter for some reason builds up, the reason could be excess pollution entering the river, the form of organic matter. It could be the death of a lot of algae that then these microbes consume and eat the and use the oxygen when they're doing that. So there's always kind of this balance, and the balance can get tipped. And that's what's happened in the Jordan River, specifically in the kind of lower reaches of the river.
Okay.
I think another thing you mentioned about the river is that you're seeing these algal blooms in the river itself, which is surprising because we've talked about those before. We've covered them, you know, a handful of times as these pop up in our local lakes. But to hear about it in a river is different and interesting and I guess concerning from my perspective. Is that something that you see, you know, regularly, annually in the Jordan River?
That's a great question. And we don't know a whole lot about the algal blooms that happen in the river. How much of, especially with the toxic algae, we don't know how much of it is coming in from Utah Lake, how much is occurring spontaneously within the river, and then how much is maybe being transported through the air. But rivers can certainly have algal blooms. Typically, we think about algal blooms happening in, still waters that don't flow very quickly. However, slow-moving rivers such as the Jordan that have a very low gradient, so there's a very small change in elevation from where it begins in Utah Lake to where it ends in the Great Salt Lake. When you don't have much change in elevation, then the river moves very slowly, and so it is possible for algae to build up and kind of be slowly transported along the river. There are still a lot of questions about that. We do know from our study and from a previous study conducted at Utah State that in-stream algal production is certainly happening in the river, and it's certainly a major part of the overall kind of cycle of organic matter that enters the river.
So it's interesting that you mentioned algae, that an algae blossom as a result of increased levels of, say, nitrogen and phosphorus that they require. And nitrogen and phosphorus are coming from different sources, could be Utah Lake, could be the effluent of wastewater treatment plants, could be runoff from farms, could be runoff from golf courses, which is a number of golf courses that lie along that river, excess fertilizer, nitrogen, phosphorus. And so algae grow, you say, Professor Smith, that algae are plants, they take in carbon dioxide and they give off oxygen. So the intuition is like, well, that must be good. But the problem comes when the algae die. And then when the algae die, bacteria, oxygen-consuming bacteria, gobble up the dead algae. And that's where, if I'm getting all this right, that's where the oxygen becomes depleted as a result of bacteria, aerobic bacteria, gobbling up the algae. So you have this whole kabuki theater going on there inside, whatever. Of algae and aerobic-based bacteria, and like you said, but it all starts from this excess excessive amounts of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus in particular, coming from different sources. And Utah Lake is a pretty disturbed lake in the fact that it is the source of a lot of algae.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So,
well, I would love to change gears and kind of switch back to this starting point that you'd kind of mentioned for the study. You had all these things you wanted to learn about, the microbial activity and the nutrient loads and those kinds of things. But in order to do that, you needed to know where the water was coming from and when it was coming from those places. So the method that you and your colleagues used to do this is pretty interesting. Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, so we used kind of a combination of methods, but the one that kind of brought everything together was the use of stable isotopes. So stable isotopes of water specifically. So water has, two elements in it, hydrogen and oxygen, or one atom of hydrogen, two atoms of hydrogen, one of oxygen. Make sure I get that right. And within those atoms, there are kind of a couple different options of or a couple different flavors of those two atoms. Those flavors are what we call isotopes. So hydrogen can either have, the flavors that are isotopes are based on the mass of protons, and so there can be kind of a heavier version or a lighter version of both hydrogen and oxygen. So we focused on the oxygen isotopes, and they're very useful because they can be used to trace sources of water that are coming in from different parts of the landscape. So the way that these isotopes work, without getting super technical about it, basically the isotope value of oxygen in a water molecule will vary depending on kind of the temperature and conditions when that water molecule condensed into water from vapor. And then it could also be altered if, it's a pool of water that's getting evaporated. So there are kind of these physical processes that affect water vapor and the liquid water. We are very fortunate to be able to use isotopes in the Salt Lake Valley because we have huge variations in the isotope value of water from the headwaters of the Jordan River in the Wasatch Mountains to a different headwater of the Jordan, Utah Lake. So these are kind of two extreme end members, Utah Lake being end members just meaning two extreme values that we could compare. Utah Lake has a very heavy value of the oxygen isotopes, so the flavor of the oxygen in Utah Lake is just on the heavier end of the spectrum, and then a much lighter flavor coming in from the Wasatch Mountains. So using those variations that we see kind of between the two extremes, we were able to determine how much water was coming from Utah Lake, Wasatch Mountains, and then also different sources kind of in between there, such as wastewater treatment plants, canals, groundwater, streams, etc.
Right.
So what did you find? What were the major and minor sources of the water?
So the major and minor sources, one of the most interesting findings is that it varies quite a bit throughout the year. And it varies not only due to kind of typical natural variations that we would expect, such as snowmelt occurring in the spring and then tapering off in the summer and fall, but also due to human interventions, such as the canals and the dams that we use to regulate the flow of the river through this highly urbanized region. So one of the most interesting findings was just that it varies a lot. The major sources in the spring, unsurprisingly, were streams and groundwater. So the Wasatch Mountains particularly, flow into the river, and they change the isotope signature quite a bit as they enter the Jordan. Another interesting finding was that Utah Lake is actually a very relatively small proportion of the flow to the river throughout the year. And especially in fall when the river, the Utah Lake input to the river is essentially turned off at the dam, at the outlet of the lake. So when that happens, the river flow goes down quite a bit overall. And in addition to no longer having snowmelt, the river is much lower in the fall. But then the relative proportion of sources shifts so that groundwater actually becomes much more important in the river during the fall period. And that was really surprising to us, that groundwater was so important, at least during certain times of year, because it's not something that we generally talk about when we think about managing water quality and flows in the Jordan River. We talk more about the snowmelt and Utah Lake and then the, you know, the human sources such as effluent.
Right. Yeah, do you know what percentage of the river flow is contributed by wastewater treatment plant effluent? There's several plants along that river.
Yep, so there are four plants that we sampled, and three of those flow directly into the river. And the relative proportion of effluent to river water varies quite a bit depending on where you are in the river and then also what time of year you're in. Obviously, in the spring, the snowmelt is really driving the river flow, and the relative influence of effluent goes way down. But the percentages vary, over space and time between 50 and approximately 50 and 10% of the river flow.
Hmm.
But the, you know, the implications for that can vary quite a bit because the plants also vary in how updated they are with their treatment and things like that.
Right. And let's be clear that most domestic wastewater treatment plants are fairly technical, engineered systems that produce very clean water, relatively speaking. In fact, there's a really interesting photo as part of the research that I was looking at that showed the confluence of effluent coming from a wastewater treatment plant and the flow upstream coming from Utah Lake, and you can see a big difference between the clarity and the turbidity of the water coming from Utah Lake versus the effluent coming out of a wastewater treatment plant. So wastewater treatment plants do a really good job these days at removing nutrients and bacteria and turbidity, et cetera.
Yes, definitely. And the wastewater treatment plants, we were actually fortunate enough to tour a few of them, and, you know, it's very impressive what they do, and just being able to walk through them and see all the different levels of treatment is really fascinating. They're always coming out with new technologies to treat the wastewater, and it's pretty neat. I really love storing wastewater treatment plants.
Yeah, me too. I'm a wastewater engineer,
so
I'm a big fan.
Huge fans. And I also love that picture. It just reminds me of the Green River and the Colorado River meeting in Canyonlands.
Okay, that's
our
the
own
visual.
Local version of
that's
the
visual.
So your specific role in this project, it sounds like, was to try to understand how the river is processing all of these nutrients that are coming into the river from the wastewater treatment plants and a lot of other sources. So what did you learn about that, or is that piece of the research still kind of in progress?
Well, it is in progress. The paper is forthcoming, but I can speak to it a bit. So basically the technique that I used to look at to answer the question of how much of the nutrient load in the river is being removed by the river itself is a pretty basic one. So it's called a mass balance. So basically, if we know what the flow of the river is and the concentration of some element at one location, and then we measure that those same two things, the flow and the concentration downstream, then what we can do is calculate the load, which is just the mass of an element per unit time in two locations. So I have 100 kilograms of nitrogen per day flowing through point A and 95 kilograms of nitrogen per day flowing 5 meters down or 5 kilometers downstream. Okay. So then if it's upstream is 100 and downstream is 95, then that difference would be, 5 kilograms per day is how much the river potentially is removing somehow.
Hmm.
So that's kind of the process that I go through to estimate how much, what potential the river has for removing nutrients. And then we have some other techniques, such as stable isotopes, that we can use to infer whether the biota are truly removing the nitrogen or if it's just flowing out of the river in some through some pathway that we haven't accounted for yet.
So what are the implications of this research moving forward for, like, Jordan River management or water management decisions in the watershed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it's always important to kind of recognize that rivers are actively processing the inputs that come in through our kind of infrastructure systems. And I think the more that we know about that, you know, if it does end up being a lot of nutrients that the river removes on its own, then that can be helpful for determining, you know, whether nutrients should be our target of for management, and if so, you know, how much can we depend on the river to do. You know, I'm not a manager, so I don't know exactly how the information might be disseminated in that way. I do try to have continual conversations with managers about that, though. And for the study that we published, I think there are some really important implications based on the water sources. This was a big unknown and a source of it was a source of uncertainty for sure, where the water comes from in the river. When we had casual conversations out in the field, for instance, everyone kind of has a different perception of what the river water is composed of. A lot of people think that it's all effluent. Others think that it's all Utah Lake water, that Utah Lake is causing all of our problems. And so I think that having a kind of a quantitative assessment of the water sources can really help to inform, you know, for every section along the river, you know, what are the potential flow paths that are delivering pollutants, and what times of year could we maybe leverage the natural sources to help kind of dilute some of the pollution issues, for instance.
Well, where can people go to learn more about this research and perhaps get a copy of the paper once it's released?
Oh, yeah, great. Well, so there's on the press release, there is a link to the paper, a download of the full length publication. And you can, and if you can't access that, you can also send me an email. I can leave my contact information on your page.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to send it out. Yeah, I know that there are a lot of different sources of information about the Jordan River, both on the website of the state's Department of Water Quality. A lot of different groups are working on the river right now. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Professor Rose Smith, she's an assistant professor in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Utah. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about this project and the Jordan River.
Thank you so much.